be fun.
So they usually say to start off with a joke. It's not very funny, but four people probably get it. Moving along. Today, we're actually here to discuss denial of service attacks, what they are, and how to prevent them. So basically, I refer to it as internet shenaniganism. It's a growing problem as the internet becomes more and more popular. So basically, well, what's the deal? The internet's not really that nice of a place anymore. It used to be when it was for academic research, but now it becomes more corporate. You're going to encounter a lot of people that are going to want to try and take you offline. So they're going to do that by consuming your internet-facing bandwidth, overpowering your CPU. So this is what we refer to as a denial of service attack. What is it? It's basically an attempt to take you offline so that your intended users can no longer use the resources that you're serving. Your web servers will stop serving web pages. Your email servers will stop sending and delivering email. Your DNS servers will stop resolving domain names, and in general, your servers are going to stop serving. So what's going to happen now is that your users are going to call you. They're going to say, my services aren't available. And if anyone works in IT, you don't want your phone to ring, right? Because that's less time you can spend posting on Slashdot. So there's several different ways that they're actually going to accomplish this. The construction of the communications medium between its intended users so that the victims can no longer communicate adequately. This could be physical, where you actually unplug an Ethernet cable, or, as you saw on the previous slide, when you cut someone's keyboard in half. You can force the victim's computer to reset, consume its resources, so that it can no longer provide the resources. Consume as much bandwidth, CPU, file handles, or any other finite resource that the computer has available. Or you can exploit a weakness in the service, causing it to crash. We're mostly going to focus on exploiting from a network side, because if we actually go into, this is a fairly broad topic, so if you go into applications and things like that, it's going to be a very long presentation. So a lot of times you can just put a firewall in front of your machine, right? That's usually the answer to it, but sometimes previous to use your firewall, sometimes you don't have the luxury of a firewall. Either your site is so high volume in doing traffic that a firewall, you can't actually have firewalls that can inspect every packet that comes in. Sometimes the budgets just don't allow for it. And so what are we going to do for that? Well, we're going to discuss ways to understand what a denial of service attack really is. Configure a FreeBSD machine to mitigate the effects of a denial of service attack. Now, I mainly use FreeBSD quite a bit, so these concepts may or may not apply to OpenBSD, NetBSD, and all the other BSDs, your module there, but FreeBSD, it should work. And at the same time, we don't want to break anything, and we want this to be as transparent to the end user as possible, because again, we don't want calls from them complaining about whatever it is they complain about. So the most common attack vectors are sending a large number of UDP packets to the target system, or sending a succession of SYN requests to a target system. So the first is what we refer to as UDP flooding, and essentially, in a nutshell, what it is, it's initiated by sending a large number of UDP packets to a machine on random ports. Now the server is going to have to check for a daemon listing on that port and determine that nothing is actually on that port, and then construct an ICMP destination unreachable. Now if you keep on sending those, the system is going to have to consume all its CPU and bandwidth to make sure that there's nothing there and send that back. So now we're going to go into something that's referred to as SYN flooding. Before we do that, you kind of have to understand a little bit of how TCP connection is established. I'm sure if anyone's ever read Chapter 1 of How the Internet Works, this is all very boring to you, but stick with me. Basically, picture how it works is, in order to establish a data exchange using TCP, we have something that's called a three-way handshake. If a machine in a client program wanted to establish a connection, first what happens is the a SYN packet is sent from the client, and this is basically just saying to the server, I want to request a connection from you. Once the server then will respond with a SYN ACK, which stands for synchronized acknowledgement, which is essentially saying that, you know, I received your request, and here's some, you know, send back some information about how they can communicate, window sizing, things like that. So then finally, the server, or the client, will then respond to the ACK, and then that's what we refer to as a three-way handshake, and it's basically the foundation of every connection established using the TCP. So behind the scenes, what's actually happening is that FreeBSD is allocating three memory structures for this. The socket structure, which is holds information related to the local end communications, like such as the protocol used, state information, addressing information, connection queues, buffers, and flags. It's also going to allocate the Internet Protocol Control Block structure, which is used by the transport layer to hold various pieces of information, such as TCP state information, IP address information, port information, also pointers to the routing tables. And this is actually created every time that a server calls the listen system function. And TCP control block structure, which is going to hold timer information, sequence information, flow status, out-of-band data as well. So every time a client SYN arrives on a valid port, the kernel will allocate these memory structures. So what a SYN flag is, when an attacker sends a SYN packet to the server, and then the server will then respond with the SYN ACK saying, I'm acknowledging your request to establish a connection. However, the attacker is going to simply discard that packet and never acknowledge it. What's going to end up happening is that you're going to have a bunch of connections that are what's called half open, where the server is sitting there waiting for the acknowledged packet to come back, and it never does. So again, it had to allocate resources to create those structures to accept the connection. And again, this is going to consume system memory. So eventually, if an attacker sends numerous ones in succession, then you can exhaust all the resources on the system, and to the point where it becomes responsive. So valid connections from your end users will never create a full connection. So SYN flooding is not entirely preventable. However, there are certain ways you can tune the TCP stack to help reduce the impact of SYN attacks and still allow legitimate connection through. In a nutshell, basically what you're doing is increasing the amount of resources available for handling connections and then limiting resources wasted processing bogus requests. So FreeBSD SYN's version 4.6 has a built-in mechanism called SYN cache. And it protects against the flooding by reducing the amount of state that's going to be kept on the server. So every connection that will pass through the SYN cache. And this actually pulls TCP options from the SYN and enough state to perform a SYN ACK retransmission. But the structure takes up less space than the TCP control block structure. So an incoming ACK for the SYN ACK that matches the SYN cache entry will cause the system to then create the TCP control block structure with the options stored in the SYN cache and then discard the SYN cache entry. So how it works is it replaces the per socket linear chain of incoming queue connections with a global hash table. Now the biggest problem with the original code in that was that it doesn't scale, mostly because it's, again, a linear list, and to ensure fairness, when the table becomes full, it would randomly drop a connection to ensure fairness. So SYN cache avoids this bottleneck by the queue becomes split up into a global hash table, which is treated as a first in, first out. So this provides an upper boundary in the amount of memory that it takes up, and it also limits the number of entries in a given hash bucket. So this is going to offer two forms of protection against running out of resources. So limit on the total number of entries on the table, will limit the memory used, but then also to the limit on the number of entries in the given hash bound will decrease the amount of time required to search for an entry to drop when the table becomes full. The question was what is the hash table, and cover that a little later in the slide. So the sync hash works by the hash value is computed on every incoming packet using the source and destination address, the source and destination port, and a randomly chosen secret. So the result is an index into a hash table. A randomly chosen secret is basically used to perturb the hash value so that an attacker cannot guess which bucket they would be targeting when establishing connections. And so now, if a new entry overflows the per bucket limit, the oldest entry in the bucket is going to be dropped. And if the total number of entries in the hash table is exceeded, the oldest entry in the global hash table is dropped. And this allows you to bound the amount of memory and CPU that's going to be required for handling incoming connections. Now, Syncache tunables. Net IMAP TCP Syncache cache limit, it determines the maximum number of Syncache entries that may be allocated globally. And then you have Syncache hash size, which controls the size of each hash table. And finally, the bucket limit, which caps the size of each hash chain. In addition to that, you also have a Syncache.retransmit limit. Now, essentially what happens is if a system doesn't receive acknowledgement of the SYNAC that was sent back to the client, it'll actually retransmit it. The default for 3BSD is 3 times. And you can actually lower that so that the entry is discarded sooner if, say, you don't hear back from after 2 times. And finally, you have a read-only variable, which is syncache.count, and this actually gives you the current number of syncache entries. You can actually use this then to figure out, based on the amount of memory and traffic that you're doing at various times, what would be proper values for that. There's no real hard answer. It depends on numerous system factors. Now, sync cookies are when a syncache bucket overflows, a fallback mechanism exists. And if an entry needs to be evicted from the syncache, the option of sending back a sync cookie, you can send back a sync cookie opposed to actually removing the entry entirely. So basically what this does is it avoids dropping connections by keeping the initial SYN state on the network. So essentially what you're doing is you're treating the network as an infinitely deep queue. So how it works is it sends a cryptographic value in the SYNAC, which is then returned in the ACK from the client. So how SYN cookies work is the client sends the SYN packet. The server responds to the SYN, but will also then discard the queue entry. So no reasons are consumed to actually keep the state. And then the server has the ability to reconstruct the queue entry using information encoded in the sequence number upon receiving the ACK back. So the first sequence numbers sent by an endpoint can be any value decided by that endpoint. However, a lot of implementations in the TCP use 0 as the initial sequence number. However, with the SYN cookie, the initial sequence numbers are actually carefully constructed according to some defined rules. Now, the basis is 128 32-bit values, which are obtained from the R4 random system call. And the source and destination address using the a port and secret hashes using MD5. Now the reason that, again, you're using a secret is because you don't want to make it, the attacker would have the ability to collect cookies and then replay them back at a later date. So what you want to do is have a secret and then also have a time limit on those secrets and continually generate them. So on FreeBSD, each secret, which is that table of 32-bit values, is generated is used for a duration of 31 milliseconds and has a total lifetime of 4 seconds. So basically the client will have within 4 seconds to respond to the SYNAC before the entry is discarded. And 4 seconds is a pretty reasonable amount of time for the return from the round trip. So now the 25 bits from the result of the hash are sent back to the client as the cookie, and then upon receiving an ACK, the computer has the ability to reverse the hashing procedure, and then if it's valid, it will establish a connection. And then if the ACK contains an invalid or expired cookie, the packet is then discarded. So there's a couple of drawbacks with Zyn cookies. One of them is that while it doesn't break any TCP protocol specifications, your server will only be limited to using 4 predefined MSS values, and because the server has to reject all TCP options, because it's disregarding the SYN queue entry, where that information would otherwise be stored. So you won't be able to do any, you won't be able to perform high performance transfers or anything like that, because again, you're limited to the type of connection, but for the most part it'll work. However, another drawback too is that it is actually fairly expensive to calculate the number, the cookies, so it's possible too that you can simply, by overflowing the table, you can cause a DOS attack by consuming all the CPU resources. Another option is to decrease the maximum segment life. It's the amount of time to wait for an ACK and reply to a SYN ACK. So if an ACK is not received in that amount of time, we consider it lost, and we just free up all the network connections. So FreeBSD is going to, by default, hold the TCP, the connection open for 30 seconds. However, it's extremely generous, considering that most will take less than a second to establish. What's interesting too is RFC 753 defines the maximum segment length as 120 seconds, but this was written in 1979. Timing issues have changed a little bit, so we can adjust it to say 7 seconds. And maybe even less, depending on how much traffic you're actually doing. And your client shouldn't notice anything. So now another option too is called TCP and UDP black hole.
Question?
Well, that's true. So the question is if you're configuring your machine that's causing issues with your client, how are they going to tell you? That's a difficult question to answer. The question is when you're configuring your machine to handle these connections and trying to still allow legitimate connections, how are you going to tell if your client is actually having issues, legitimate requests are being dropped. So, time and things like that, same cookies. Well, again, you can, that's a good sentence, actually. Screw it, I don't care. What's that? So, UDP, TCP and UDP black hole. This allows you to control what happens when a packet is received on a closed port, when there's a port where there's nothing listening. So if a packet arrives on a closed port, it'll just be dropped with no notification being sent back from the client. This will save you some CPU and bandwidth because you won't have to send the request back. For TCP, you have the ability to set net INET TCP black hole to 1, which will drop just SYN packets that arrive on another version. Comment?
Facebook
stops working. I'm happy to that. Just
any questions for everybody except
so if we set black hole to 1 for TCP, it'll drop just SYN packets. If we set it to 2, it'll drop all TCP packets. Now we can set UDP, well, we can only control what UDP is. They only have one option to either respond or not respond because UDP is a stateless protocol. So if we set it to 1, it's just going to drop all UDP packets. However, it should be noted that by ignoring these packets, you're going to break through certain things like traceroute because so things like traceroute will be broken. And now another, we can move down the stack a little bit to optimizing device performance. And what's interesting about this too is that even if you don't have to worry about denial of service attacks, a lot of these techniques can actually just be used if you're running high performance web servers or just a site that does a lot of traffic in general. So traditionally, each time a network card needs to make a request, it'll generate an interrupt request. So now this the request causes a context switch and a call to an interrupt handler. So context switching is basically when the CPU and kernel have to switch between user and kernel lanes. And this is actually an extremely expensive operation. So device polling is going to change the method through which your kernel gets data from its network card. So this is going to provide more control to the operating system of how and when to handle devices. So essentially what you're doing is allowing the kernel at certain predefined times to pull the network. These predefined times are basically at defined intervals that are hard-coded during idle loops, during clock interrupts, and on PC, so the clock, there's a clock interrupt every 100 times per second, excuse me. So we can then hold the network for that. So essentially what you're doing is allowing your kernel to decide when it's efficient to pull for updates and for how long. And unfortunately, not all network cards are supported by this. A couple of the more popular ones are the Deca Intel 21143s, the Intel Ether Express Pro. And I actually have a couple of these cards that are very well supported, and you can pick them up for about $10. So, yeah, Realtek, Fast Ethernet Driver, and the Sys900. There's a couple others that aren't listed, and the list is growing every day, but for the most part, unfortunately, not all your network cards are supported at this time. Finally, the other option is to disable auto-negotiation. So you can say every time that a link, the machine comes up and it will negotiate with the switch to see what speed it can communicate with. So the switcher service sets you auto-negotiation. Every few minutes, it's going to stop transferring network traffic in order to renegotiate the speed. This isn't 100% true in some of your cheaper switches that you can just deal with the link system. It'll only negotiate when the link first comes up or when the link goes away and then comes back. But on the more expensive ones, it'll never be possible to achieve wire speed if you have auto negotiation turned on. Finally, we can do something called accept filter HTTP. So if you're running a web server, what this allows you to do is buffer incoming connections until a complete HTTP request arrives. So what it's doing is it's delaying the return from the accept system call until a certain condition has been met, in this case, a complete HTTP request. So the server is not going to have to context switch as much to perform the initial parsing of the request. So This is going to postpone the requirement for a child process to handle the new connection, and that will increase the number of connections that a given child process can handle. So it's going to reduce the amount of CPU required to handle incoming incoming requests by keeping active processes like pre-forking Apache servers.
Where is it done?
That's actually done in the kernel.
Is it on the web server in the kernel?
No, you actually, not really. You have code in the kernel that essentially allows you to buffer the entire request before it's passed off to Apache. So normally it would have to then, you know, context switch back and forth to parse the request. So essentially when you have a full request, that is then passed to child Apache server. So, actually, I'm pretty fast. That's about it. So where can we go from here? You can read the tuning man page. This also documents a lot of other things, such as, you know, tuning your hard drives and things like that. Another great resource is to just post to talk at list.nicebug.org, or you can just email me directly. And any questions? For meldings, so for send meld, there's actually a bunch of things you can do. That actually be a good talk for another one. All kinds I don't know. I'm sure there's things you can do. Because an incoming IMAP actually the question was, is there anything I do to speed up IMAP, which is a fairly broad question, but because reading email, you'd be reading off a disk, there's probably some things you can do at the disk IO level to... Offhand, I don't know. So. So that becomes fairly difficult. We actually,
The
question is.
The question
is that when your upstream providers are actually having difficulty mitigating the effects of a DDoS, so usually what they would do is put things like NetBlocks in place to essentially just block connections coming from certain parts of the internet. Prey is a good one.
There's also another judge who's got a company start out in Las Vegas. He does take all his traffic through him, and he's here with just about everybody. He's really big pipes. He has DDoS migration and everything. Not the guy's name, but a lot of the online working and stuff, you've seen him. And he has this custom thing that filters everything out for him. And does a good job getting rid of DDoS and taking out everything where it's modeled and taking down your site. You know, F now is still the world cup. And you can do that if you have one.
Show up for like
could be that sounds out of Vegas?
I don't know if they're out of Vegas. I know they're really expensive.
Yeah, but
thousands of dollars for you.
Yeah. I don't know if they're out of Vegas. I'll have to say that I'm going to go back to the black hole technology and figure out that.
BGP is a little out of even my scope. I don't do a lot of peering with other sites, so we have other people that handle that. So I'm absolutely underqualified to comment on that at all. So.
I'm curious just how people have dealt with these various scenarios they've dealt with. Like, the last time was like a year and a half ago. I had like a pop US attack going on. We found out because our mail server, hey, why can't I pop this mail server? And sat there and like, if you play games, if your ISP isn't being cooperative, then you're like, kind of like, okay, it was actually in a jail also. So it was kind of, you know, roundabout way, there's no firewall running on the box. It's free BSD. So like, I mean, basically it stopped after what was apparently a zombie box. You know, I called the net block on. I mean, it literally just went on. I mean, really, you know, nothing you can do if I didn't have cooperation, you know? So I'm curious what other people's scenarios are, but the practical, like day to day, how you do it, when it's happening.
Yeah, I lost connection to my ISP and I wasn't getting connection, so I pulled up on my ISP and I was going on and that helped me. So what I ended up doing is I was going to part of the gateway and then I received a lot of addresses and I was going to walk in front of the ISP.
How is the IDS actually dealing with your bandwidth with getting saturated? Because even if the IDS is dealing with it, you can't, right? It's still over your copper. So to elaborate on what George was saying, he was basically saying, how do you deal with a malware service attack when your requests that are coming in all look like legitimate requests? We actually had a problem with that at a former company of ours where we were essentially brought to our knees because a Brazilian kid, a 16-year-old kid, and like we had pictures of him, and we called his parents to tell him what he was doing, because like, they didn't care. We actually had a botnet of around 10,000 compromised machines and just wrote a Perl script that would make DNS requests to our name servers. And essentially, our DNS servers were spending so much time dealing with his bogus requests that we legitimate connections were not being established. One of the options we had was to work with our upstream provider to see where the most amount of requests are coming from and just establish large net blocks. But then the problem is with that too is that a lot of the machines are from South America and a lot of our requests are legitimate requests also originate from South America. So we were denying, legitimate requests were being denied because of this
kid, but at the same time, to mitigate the damage, we essentially had to then deny requests until things started to clear up. And one of the interesting things about it, too, was that it was actually one of the largest DDoSes that our department had ever dealt with. I think we were doing 3 gigabit a second. Is that right, Nate? Something like that. And they estimated it to be around 10 to 15,000 machines. Now, keep in mind, this was a 16-year-old kid that had this access. And what was interesting is that he actually wrote a script that used Google to search for instances of PHPBB, which is an open source bulletin board system that was running that had a remotely compromisable exploit. And then from there, he just amassed a large amount of a large botnet and just turned it against us. And it's kind of funny to think that, like, you know, a 16-year-old kid would be able to do that, but they can. And the thing that's really annoying is that he was actually in Brazil, and Brazil doesn't have any computer crime laws. So when we brought in the FBI, they were essentially saying, well, we really can't do anything. First, because these are really hard to investigate. And the funny thing was that we were able to give the FBI a picture of him, his address, and his phone number. And they still weren't able to do anything because, again, Brazil had no, that's not considered a crime in Brazil. It is here, but not there. So the only thing we were able to do was have the CEO of the company call the kid's parents and say, listen, you know, this is what's happening. So, you know, protecting your... What's funny, too, is that a lot of these, when he would actually start to pack at us, when he would, you know, start his denial of service tax, they were always around, like, 3:30, 4 o'clock when he would get home from school, which was just hilarious. So.
So basically, you don't have to be able to manage the problem.
Couldn't you pay, like, some of the bullying kids you do to beat him up?
And then the really interesting thing was, now, I never actually read any of his email, but he was actually speaking with people in Romania who were then paying him in pornography to then turn his botnet against other machines. So, I mean, we might have been able to pay him off really cheaply, but nothing ever really came of it.
How long did that go on?
A couple months, actually. Yeah, so I mean, the only thing that we were able to do then to was to outsource our DNS to another company that essentially has a network that's capable of handling that their business is to, you know, serve DNS requests and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, you can take part of them down.
Again, so the tricky part is how do you end up dealing with requests that look like, that are actually legitimate requests? So now, another thing too is that if you have a website and every time you view a page it's a result of making SQL queries against a database, well then, you know, you can just make a bunch of HTTP requests and end up, you know, using up all the CPU handling those database queries. Yes. So again, so the thing is that, you know, at that level, it becomes an extremely broad topic and it's something that has to be, you know, something you have to consider on a case-by-case basis of what are your available options to yourself. Well, when you send back, the question is, do you know of a packet normalizer that you can place in between the SYN cookie to essentially clean it up? However, the...
Well, not
or
to... Not to let it pass
through that.
Well,
remember that the... So what you're doing now is when you send back... on a normal connection, what you're doing is the SYN-ACK is sending back its initial sequence number. So what you're doing is actually, rather than just letting that be an arbitrary number, you're constructing that number to be, you're predetermining the value of that number. And then what you're doing is when you receive the ACK back from the client, you strip one from that number and then perform the reverse of the encoding to decode it, and then if that number, if the end result of that decoding ends up being zero, then you assume that the connection is valid. So you're
normalizer preserves that back number.
Right. Which you would have to do because that's required by the protocol to preserve the ISM. Alright, so anyone else? Going once, going twice? Alright, so
to the bar.
So it's a close one, but I just want to wish happy birthday to Sonia. She's sitting right back there. She actually just got here, and I thought I was going to waste the slide because she wasn't here, but...
Everybody!
I'm done, but while I still have everyone's attention, I really want to just thank Erin, who is sitting right next to her in the red hair. She was the one that basically put this PowerPoint presentation together for me. So while the content was mostly garbage, the design itself was phenomenal, and I couldn't have done it without her. So thank you so much.
Yay.
And that's it, folks. Let's go drinking.
Okay, just real quick, Cap. We're going to Broom Street Bar, which is again.